Welcome to the Shining 237, the podcast. My name is Susan Tekla Kriglenska. This is the podcast where we examine The Shining, the Kubrick masterpiece, in 2 minute and 37 second chunks. Today we are going to be doing episode one from 000 to 2 minutes and 37 seconds into the movie. We start with a black screen and we end with the title credit saying screenplay by Stanley Kubrick and Diane Johnson. My first guest is Joe Dader, cartoonist from The New Yorker and one of my favorite podcasters. Hi, Joe.
Joe Dader's not here, Mrs. Torrance. Joe Dader went away. Hello.
Dang. Hi, Joe.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Joe is not only one of the most popular New Yorker cartoonists.
Joe, no, I'm not. Is.
Yeah, you are. You are. We should say, this entire program is inspired by what was started several years ago, the Star Wars Minute. Pete the Retailer and Alex Robinson started a show where they examined Star Wars in 1 minute chunks. Every minute of the movie was examined per podcast episode. And they kind of launched this trend of these kinds of podcasts. And so we're now part of that family. It's the movie right. Minute family of podcasts, although I'm doing 2 minutes and 37 seconds. And so Joe was actually on the original Recipe Star Wars Minute podcast, the first one, and has been on everyone ever since. And he's one of their most popular guests. And a lot of people really love him from that program.
I'm the most popular guest currently in my apartment.
Yes, in your basement apartment in Queens. Joe and I actually did Aliens Minute once, and it was so much fun and really inspired me to do this.
Yeah, great. John Engel is a great podcaster who is doing a minute-by-minute examination of the Alien movies, starting with Alien and now moving on to Aliens.
Right, and hopefully all of these guys are going to be guests on this program, too. So
yeah, and I should say we're following in their footsteps, unless they decide to backtrack in their footsteps to throw us off the trail.
Right, and then cower behind a hedge, hiding from us. My other guest today, I'm very thrilled to have Megan Dooley from 3,000 miles away on the, what some may consider, the best coast. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Megan.
Hello. Hi there.
From a little yellow house in California.
Yes.
Megan is a absolute cinephile. She knows way more about movies than I do, so I'm thrilled to have her here about the history of movies. She's a total expert and also a photographer who has an amazing eye for movie stills. Okay, well, let's just get started. So we are going through the first 2 minutes and 37 seconds. We start with a black screen, and then the first thing we see is the Warner Brothers logo.
It's Warner Bros. It's always Warner Bros.
Mm-hmm. Warner Bros.
It's
Warner Bros. For Warner Hose.
And best of all, the home of Bugs Bunny, who we will be meeting already at episode two, we'll be meeting Bugs Bunny in The Shining.
With Roadrunner.
And Roadrunner.
For a very, very short time, Warner Brothers was considering a prequel to The Shining. And this is going back about 5 years or so. It was going around in the trade press. I think it was the screenwriter who had written Shutter Island was working on a treatment for a prequel to The Shining, which would have shown, I assume, the history of the Colorado property. In any event, it was a terrible idea.
Yes.
And I'm very, very glad that it went nowhere.
That's a rotten, rotten idea.
I 100% agree with you. I always thought it was weird, actually, that there has not been the Grady story. I think it's kind of amazing that Hollywood has not done that yet, since The Shining is such an institution. But if they do it, I'd like to write it. All right. Kubrick was working with MGM mostly for most of his career. He started with Warner Bros. With The Clockwork Orange and finished with them at his death with Eyes Wide Shut. Okay, we go from the logo to black to the opening shot, which I think is one of the greatest opening shots in any movie. It's a aerial view of what we now know is Glacier National Park.
Right.
We are supposed to assume it's the Rockies because that's where this film takes place.
Not Maine.
It's definitely not Maine. Yeah.
Not Maine.
Not Maine. It is not Maine.
That's
it's
right.
Montana.
Yes.
And we are hit with two things. We are flying through the air looking at this incredible scene, and we are hit with the music. So I want to talk about both of those things at once very quickly. Okay, so the music. So let me say that we're going to have at least one musicologist on the series talking about the music. So we'll definitely get a lot more into the music of The Shining. I think the music adds so much to the horror of it. It's just impossible to understate how important the music is to scaring the crap out of you in this movie.
Yeah.
If you watch this movie without the music, it's a whole other experience. Mm-hmm. We open with the notes that were from a piece by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkind. Wendy Carlos had done music for Clockwork Orange. Mm-hmm. Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkind, famous in the mainstream for Switched on Bach. That's one of their claim to fame. Mm-hmm. But also for some amazing, groundbreaking, you know, revolutionary electronic music. Mm-hmm. The notes actually are famously taken from a mid 13th century
Requiem.
Liturgical. Requiem. Yeah. It's Dies Irae.
Apologies to all the Latin speakers.
Exactly. So it ended up being a part of the Roman Catholic funeral ceremony. Mm. It sounds completely different. It started as a chant that evolved into a piece of music, and it sounds pretty different from what we hear in The Shining. But what we do hear sounds exactly like what Berlioz did with the Dies Irae. Mm. Berlioz did a piece called Symphonie Fantastique that was in five parts. The fifth part was Dream of the Night of the Sabbath. The Berlioz piece was written in 1830. Berlioz did his own interpretation of Dies Irae. Wendy Carlos played that for Kubrick. He listened to it over 100 times. He was obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. And what we're opening this podcast with are the notes from the Berlioz Symphony. And as you can hear, it's exactly the same pretty much of what Wendy Carlos used, these terrifying notes that she starts with.
It's called Day of Wrath also. So that's kind of a,
yes,
kind of a hat tip towards which way this is going to go.
And then the vocal sounds and the,
the vocal sounds are what
accents
really make it. You take it for, there's so much that you take for granted watching it now. The music, how kind of like commonplace it is now to have like human sounds in orchestra pieces or instrumental pieces. Now it's easy. I mean, back then you had to have a whole room full of tape recorders and reel-to-reel things. And
the layering in this movie, there are parts of the movie where he has like four layers of sound going on as far as just music itself. Yeah. Now, Rachel Elkind is the vocalist that Wendy Carlos then kind of warped her voice into these trills and these sort of human-sounding bird calls.
Keening.
Yeah, spooky. Kubrick liked to call these sounds that they were making flybys. Which is exactly what it feels like, especially in conjunction with what we're looking at.
Yeah, what I do want to mention before we move on from the music is that I am going to be doing an episode of my podcast, Songs You're Sick Of, where I analyze the lyrics to this song.
So, yes.
And the lyrics are. And we're going to look into like what those lyrics mean. A lot of them were cribbed from popular songs of the time. I'm kidding.
These vocal sounds are also rather similar to some of the tribal music and vocals of traditional Native American ceremonies. You can actually find on YouTube some really great examples of that. And it really is close to it. So I would say this is a piece of evidence that there is some attachment to a Native American theme to this movie. That's, of course, open to interpretation. So we are looking at beautiful, swooping, soaring, and slightly off kilter at times, helicopter shots created by Greg McGillivray. So the reason Greg McGillivray is interesting is that he invented a piece that goes in front of a helicopter to hold the camera. This was a new film technique that reflected, just by complete coincidence in time, the Steadicam. It was something that could hold the camera incredibly stable, able to take all the shock. And that's why nobody had gotten these kinds of aerial shots before. This was an absolute first in how smooth and beautiful these shots are.
Yet another thing we take for granted. Nowadays, they can just do something like that with the drone, whereas back then you had to invent an entire piece of equipment and then strap it to a helicopter and then fly that low over a lake and then go up and manage not to crash the thing. I think it was very dangerous, actually, for the pilot to do that. Yeah.
Sure.
It took them weeks to... he was meticulous, just like Kubrick is. That's why Kubrick hired him. He was meticulous. He went weeks and weeks. The weather was constantly changing in Montana, you know, in this particular area. And so they had to... he put an enormous amount of work into this.
What they ended up with was 17 hours of footage.
This is a... little bit of a reflection of what we're going to see later in the movie with the Steadicam. This movie is famous for its use of the Steadicam, which had just been invented by Garrett Brown. We're going to get into that later on the series. And Joe, talk about what else happened with this footage. It ended up elsewhere in the world.
It also ran over the end credits of Blade Runner 2 years later. In the original theatrical release of Blade Runner, there was a tacked-on sort of happy ending where Deckard and Rachel escaped to the country. Mm-hmm. Ridley Scott had shot some stuff up in the hills and mountains, I forget where, and wasn't satisfied with the footage. And he remembered The Shining, and he personally called Stanley Kubrick and asked him if he could have this footage.
Pretty nervy.
Yeah.
Another sort of connection... 6 degrees of whatever you want to call it between Stanley Kubrick is working on Blade Runner on the visual effects was Douglas Trumbull. And he also worked on 2001.
2001, right.
So he might have had maybe that's why he felt so comfortable, you know, calling him up and asking him about that, because Trumbull was a great, great person to have solutions for Stanley's impossible problems. So.
Oh, he was brilliant person.
Yeah.
Now, the yellow car, two things to just mention quickly. One, in the book, it's a red car, and some surmise that that's a little knock at Mr. King, that he didn't use a red car, because it's very prominently in the book, a little red Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. He used a yellow one, and it will come up again later in the movie. Mm-hmm. Again, the possibility of him knocking Stephen King with the color of the car. And then the other thing is, in that car, as we're looking at it from our eagle eye view, there are three people in that car dressed up as Jack, Wendy, and Danny.
Can you see them? You can really see them?
No, you can't. You really can't see them.
Oh,
but,
my God.
But they did it. They did it. They were in the exact same clothes as the characters. So
Stanley would know.
Stanley would know. Would know.
The audience may not see, but Stanley would know.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you even see the one of the few little kind of mistakes as you see the shadow of the helicopter briefly.
Right. Stanley Kubrick had seen that mistake, but when they were first editing, they were editing The Shining electronically, which was kind of a new thing for Stanley Kubrick and in the industry in general. He used some of the earliest Betamax editing systems when he was editing these shots. And unfortunately, the system wasn't showing the film in full frame. So it changed the frame ratio. And so they did not see the helicopter shot while they were editing. Then they eventually did see it, but agreed that they wanted the shot. It was more important. So it was a mistake, but Kubrick kept it in because he loved the shot, which is pretty interesting, again, because he's such a perfectionist. So now coming up, we have the neon blue credits beginning to roll. Now, to me, that's a little bit of a what the hell moment. Is the Helvetica font and the electric blue.
Well, not so much the font, but I mean, before he'd been using the Helvetica for at least since Clockwork Orange, but he was primarily known for doing title cards instead of a credit roll. That was a bit
rolling
of a jar.
Yeah.
Well, I love the way the credits come up in this film, because they come up very slowly and they come up from the bottom to the top. And they come up one at a time. There's never two on screen at a time, which was it was very unconventional at the time.
Yeah.
And I just love the pacing of that. And I really love the sort of deliberate way that that's happening. And the cast is announced, and I wonder if they're in order of importance.
Negotiate that. Let me first say, the way it rolls does match very nicely with the way the camera is soaring, again, like an eagle. And I forgot to mention, eagle is a little bit of a theme in this movie. So the fact that we're soaring through the sky like an eagle reflects a lot of the theme of the movie. Eagle will come up over and over again, and we'll talk about that a lot more. We start with a Stanley Kubrick film is the first thing it says. I just want to mention really quickly, I'd like to do a bonus episodes on his individual movies. Mm-hmm. And the only movie that was totally within his control, so that's excluding Spartacus, that does not mention Stanley Kubrick first is Eyes Wide Shut. In Eyes Wide Shut, the first credit is Tom Cruise.
Yes.
And then Stanley Kubrick. That has never happened in any other Stanley Kubrick film. Mm. And I think that's kind of interesting. I think it reflects a little bit the control Tom Cruise might have had in a way that was a little overpowering to Stanley Kubrick. That's a whole other thing. So, all right, we start with a Stanley Kubrick film. We then have the name Jack Nicholson.
Big star.
Jack Nicholson actually had known Kubrick for years. They had a mutual friend who was a photographer at Look magazine. So they actually kind of knew each other for even before Jack was famous. Kubrick had wanted Jack for Napoleon. Now, Stanley Kubrick wanted to and worked on and had an entire script. One of his big dreams was to do a monumental biopic on Napoleon. And he was interested in Jack Nicholson, which seems like an odd choice to me.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Doesn't look like him. I could see Marlon Brando more as like younger Marlon Brando, but not so much Jack Nicholson. A little too new world looking.
Yeah, it's a very strange choice. On the other hand, Jack Nicholson for The Shining is just like, you know, perfect. There really wasn't any question that Jack Nicholson was going to be playing this. There's some names floated around by the studio, but I don't think Kubrick ever even looked at those. So Jack Nicholson at this point had been acting for a lifetime, an entire lifetime.
Yeah, and writing, apparently. I knew he had written some scripts or co-written scripts early in his career, but apparently he's still pretty well paid anonymous script doctor sometimes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He did co-write Head with the Monkees.
Right.
And Bob Rafelson, who he worked with a lot.
Right.
His big break had been Roger Corman, Little Shop of Horrors. Now, back when Jack Nicholson was acting for Corman, I think he was a terrible actor. He had, go look at the 1963 movie, The Terror. And tell me that's good acting. I don't think
Do you know why The Terror was made?
Why?
The Terror was made because after filming The Raven, Corman realized he had Boris Karloff for one more day.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And still so had the set.
So he made another, and still had the set, so they made another movie.
Yep.
So they rammed that one through. Well, yeah. I still say Jack Nicholson, you can see in that movie, he's not a natural actor, but he was a smart actor who knew how to pick out great directors, great scripts, great productions. And he just was in so many movies and in so many great movies and worked with so many great directors. I think that's what made him into a very good actor. I still don't think he had a lot of range. He had, of course, done 5 Easy Pieces, Easy Rider.
Well, his big movies up to that point had been Chinatown and Cuckoo's Nest. Those were his two biggest starring roles at that point. I do also love The Last Detail.
Of course, Jack won the Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. My favorite is The Passenger, the Antonioni film.
I think Jack is perfect and is to this day a controversial casting choice. The Stephen King purists have a big problem with Jack Nicholson being cast in this role. But any other actor I could see in this role would be equally sort of wide-eyed and kooky. Bruce Dern, a Christopher Walken, possibly.
Right. Now, at this time, Jack Nicholson also was in a weird place in life. A few years earlier, you know, he had learned these odd revelations about his family life. He had just broken up with Angelica Houston, which was a big relationship for him. He had lent his home to Roman Polanski, who was then accused of rape in his own home. And the Manson murders happened all before the filming of The Shining.
When the Manson murders happened after they discovered
who it was, and that a lot of people in Hollywood, one way or another, had had some either direct or casual acquaintance to the people who were accused of the murders at the Tate Estate. Everyone got really, really paranoid and afraid, and there was suddenly everyone had walls, everyone had gates, everyone had security. People, Steve McQueen started carrying guns with them.
And Jack Nicholson in particular was completely shaken up to his core. I've read he was sleeping with a hammer under his pillow.
That's a terrifying thought.
He actually attended some of the trial, I believe. He was pretty obsessed, and some say he based part of his role of Jack Torrance on Manson, which is a little bit freaky when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, he was not known for being a crazy, unpredictable person on the set. In work, he was always known for being incredibly professional.
Right. But in his social life, known for the parties, for the cocaine, I mean, you know, there definitely was a reputation. Kubrick, one of his most trusted assistants, Emilio Alessandro, who, you know, there's a documentary focusing on him and his work with Kubrick. And he's this sweet, sweet Italian man with just very not someone who would fit into this picture very well. And he actually asked not to have to deal with Jack Nicholson. He was very freaked out by him on the set of The Shining. So that's sort of interesting. All right. So the next name rolling up on the credits is Shelley Duvall. Now, Jack Nicholson wanted Jessica Lange to play Wendy. That was his adamant suggestion.
I guess he saw her being terrorized by King Kong.
Right. And she actually matches the Wendy in Stephen King's novel a little more closely. Shelley Duvall was Stanley Kubrick's only choice. He always wanted Shelley Duvall, which is actually also very interesting. It's a strange pick when you read the book. It's an opposite character. This is one of the opposite characters where Stanley just flipped the character on its head. In the book, Wendy is a ex-cheerleader, blonde, pretty girl, which is mainly how Stephen King describes her. And she's a much more forceful character. She's got much more sort of control over the situations, is much more vocal and that kind of thing. So Jessica Lange would kind of make sense if you had just read the book, but Stanley Kubrick always wanted Shelley Duvall. She had been obviously working with Robert Altman before. And then, of course, Shelley Duvall did The Shining and Popeye as a pairing, yes, which is insane.
Well, that was in the same year, and it's why I love Shelley Duvall, and she is a criminally underrated actress, and
absolutely
evidence of it is the fact that she appeared in this film and in Popeye as Olive Oil in both in 1980, and those are two brilliant performances. Her performance as Olive Oil is absolutely incredible, and she is Olive Oil. The other thing I want to mention about Shelley Duvall is that in doing my research, I found out that there are a great deal of people online who believe she and Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters are the same person. And they're not. They're actually not.
They're not. No. I'm pretty sure they're not.
Well, what would have been her biggest role up to this point?
It would have been Three Women. Three Women was the previous movie, and
But she's in Nashville. She's in Robert Altman's Nashville. Wouldn't that have been...
Yeah, Nashville was, I guess, the biggest movie. Thieves Like Us was a major role. She was the co-star in that. But she had a memorable bit part
in Annie Hall.
Right.
As the Rolling Stone journalist who Alvy Singer has sex with and remarks afterwards, I'm starting to get the feeling back in my jaw.
Yes. But her biggest role was definitely Three Women. She won some awards for that. And she is amazing in that movie.
I've never seen that.
Well, Three Women, if you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing. It's a little bit of a weird abstract movie, but...
It's a strange movie. There's really not a plot arc to speak of.
She created that character. She added a lot of improv from her in that. A lot of her making up characteristics of this personality that is actually kind of a annoying woman, but you still love her and sympathize with her. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant role.
Also, she, looking into her background, she was discovered as a makeup counter salesperson, and she never did any acting school or acting lessons, whereas Jack Nicholson was very much always involved in some kind of lessons or teachers. So very much kind of a clashing of acting styles.
The next title that comes up says The Shining.
You don't see anyone actually shining anything. You don't see like a shoe shine, like shoes being shined.
Stephen King came up with that title from John Lennon's song Instant Karma, We All Shine On. It's a little, just a little interesting. Yeah, a little interesting thing to know.
That's so Stephen King, right? It's such a classic rock reference.
Yeah. Danny Lloyd's name now comes sneaking up on the screen. He was between 5.5 and 6.5 during the shooting. 5.5. Kubrick's first choice for the role of Danny was Carrie Guffey, who had been the child in Close Encounters of a Third Kind. That was his absolute first. Carrie's parents turned down the role due to this film subject matter.
Carrie Guffey, who really, I heard him in an interview recently. He's about 35 now, and he's a pretty happy guy, pretty happy to talk about being in Close Encounters. But God damn it, he needs to change his name to Gary Cuffey, because it's really hard to say Carrie Guffey.
Yes.
I mean, come on, pal. You're making it hard for everybody.
See, now I can't forget his name because Gary Cuffey.
It's impossible not to say his name the wrong way.
Gary Guffey, can't stop.
No, it's Carrie Guffey. He's Carrie Guffey. Your tongue wants to say, every human tongue wants to say Gary Cuffey, like a normal person would say.
All right, so to find Danny Lloyd, Stanley Kubrick had worked with Leon Vitale on Barry Lyndon. Leon Vitale is amazing in that movie. Some of the best scenes are with Leon Vitale. And he was interested in moving on from being an actor and getting more into film. So he asked Stanley if he could assist him. So his first task was to find the kid to play Danny Torrance. They took out ads in the Midwest because they wanted kind of a Midwest accent. 5,000 kids responded. They narrowed it down to 120. Stanley had said to Leon what he wanted in a child. It was a child with mobile features, and he wanted the child's muscles to be connected to his nerve center by a direct line. Those were his instructions. And I look for
that in a cell phone too. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, nowadays that's a procedure you can have done.
Yes.
You can have your child,
or you can have Botox to stop that.
You want your child to make it big in movies, you go and have them get this procedure.
Danny Lloyd only did one other thing besides this movie. He did
He played a young G.
Right.
Gordon Liddy.
Yes.
And it's hard not to watch The Shining thinking there goes a little. It's like watching a little child version of G. Gordon Liddy.
Yep. Yes.
You just see him like holding a lighter and holding his hand over it, you know. What's the trick? The trick is not minding the pain, you know.
Danny ended up leaving showbiz and becoming a biology professor. That's what he does now.
Good choice.
Scatman Crothers is the next name.
Scatman Crothers. Died 1986.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot to say about Scatman later when we see him on screen. I will just briefly say he was a very ubiquitous figure on TV in the 1970s.
Yes.
If you were anywhere, he was a guest on Sanford and Son. He was a frequent cast member on Chico and the Man, playing Louis the Garbage Man.
Yes.
And he was on variety shows. He was on talk shows. Yeah. He was an all-around entertainer.
Yeah, songwriter.
Hundreds of songs.
Vaudevillian. He had done everything. Mm-hmm. And he had also appeared in three other films before this with Jack Nicholson.
That's right.
He was good friends with.
Hmm.
He had been in One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
He had been in The King of Marvin Gardens, directed by Bob Rafelson. And he had appeared in Mike Nichols' film, The Fortune.
That's right.
All with Jack Nicholson.
Right. Now, Stanley Kubrick's first pick for this was Slim Pickens.
Slim Pickens, right, yeah.
Which is interesting because Slim is a
Strangelove.
And he's a white guy. Now, in the
Dick Halloran is identified as a black man in the book.
Yes.
Now, Kubrick wanted Slim Pickens for the role because Slim Pickens had worked with him on Dr. Strangelove.
Yes. Right.
And Slim Pickens did not want to be in the movie for the exact same reason.
Yes.
Exactly. He was like, no, thank you.
Beat me to that joke, yes.
Yeah, Slim did not want to work with Kubrick again. He found it really difficult, as did many people. Scatman was 69 when he did this.
Wow.
So it was a lot of physical work for him, especially the final scene that he's in.
I can't imagine anyone else in this role.
No.
He's so good and so iconic in this role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such, he's he's so beautifully, perfectly cast. Mm-hmm. I certainly can't imagine Slim Pickens.
Yeah.
No.
No, God, no.
Playing this
actually,
part.
Actually, someone had given Scatman The Shining by Stephen King, the novel, way when it had come out, and said, this part, this guy wrote this thinking about you. A friend of Scatman's actually suggested that Stephen King might have had Scatman Crothers in his head when he wrote that part, because it was so exactly, you know, that kind of a matching personality. So Scatman already was interested in that role.
But as I say, he was ubiquitous on television in the 1970s as a frequent guest on variety shows and sitcoms, and was probably best known to people of my generation as the voice of Hong Kong Phooey.
Yes. Unmistakable scratchy voice.
Right. Okay. So now next in the credits is Barry Nelson.
Barry Nelson. Technically the first James Bond.
Yes.
On television.
That's correct.
Television's 1954. He played James Bond before anybody
Jimmy
else.
Jimmy Bond.
Had a long, long, long career. Mm. He has an IMDb list as long as your arm.
Yes.
Worked a great deal. And died in 2007 and worked pretty much right up to that point.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
He was in Airport, the 1970 original film Airport, as well.
Mm-hmm. He was also a Broadway star. He was you know, very serious Broadway actor as well. And he, of course, you know, was in some of that classic television, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Twilight Zone, and all those things. He did a lot of game shows, and there's a lot of clips on YouTube of him on game shows, which is kind of great. And there's a whole entire episode of him doing Password with Joan Crawford that you can watch.
Oh, wow.
I'll link to that on the website.
He also
guested as a hobo on an episode of The Ropers, which is not on YouTube. So somebody go find that, please, and post it if you can.
Yes.
Next person on the list is Philip Stone. He is one of two people who have appeared in three Kubrick movies. For him, it was consecutive. Mm-hmm. He was the father in A Clockwork Orange. He was a lawyer in Barry Lyndon, and he was, of course, Grady here in The Shining.
Yes,
in my favorite scene in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
He had been also a play actor. Had been, you know, he was from the UK and had been in a lot of plays, the Young Vic and Old Vic and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. All the Vics.
He did lots of TV on the BBC. He was in Thunderball, Flash Gordon, Temple of Doom. It probably could have been a much bigger star if he had come to the United States, actually, I think. And he died in 2003 at the age of 79. Okay, and next...
Which brings us now to the second Blade Runner connection.
Yes.
In this segment. Aside from some of the footage being reused, is cast member Joe Turkle.
Yes.
That's right. Joe Turkle was also in three Kubrick movies. He was in The Killing in a very small role. He was in a very prominent role in Paths of Glory. Amazing job in that.
Yeah.
Right. And he died in Not Yet.
Not yet. Yes.
Still alive.
Still with us. God bless him.
He's currently 90 years old. Yes. His last acting credit was in 1998, but he has a long list of credits going back to the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And again, a very busy actor who just worked in a huge amount. The only thing I want to call out specifically is that he appeared on an episode of Kojak playing a character named Swamp Gas.
Oh, man. See,
I've never seen that episode of Kojak. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see Joe Turkel as Swamp Gas.
Okay, that's another one. Someone out there, please go find that for us and post
it. Yes, please. I'm sure it's on DVD somewhere.
And of course, iconically, Dr. Elton Tyrell in... Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's Tyrell.
Yeah. Tyrell.
Blade Runner.
Yeah, I was surprised to see him turn up in Village of the Giants as the sheriff.
Oh,
wow!
And is terrorized by the giant teens and their giant bosoms.
Wow! So. And he just and when you read interviews with him, he just comes off as a fabulous guy. I mean, I'm from Brooklyn. From Brooklyn, yes, Brooklyn guy. Next, we have Ann Jackson, who plays the doctor in the scenes at the beginning of the movie. A few of these people have just died very recently. She only died in 2016, last year.
Yeah, died in 2016. She was well known for being a Broadway actor and frequently appeared with her husband, Eli Wallach.
Yes.
Right.
who died about a year before she did, or 2 years before she did. Mm-hmm. He died in 2014, I think, at the age of like 200. I don't know. Yeah. He was really old. The only thing I want to say about Anne Jackson is that she is not, as I believed up until yesterday, related to Glenda Jackson.
No.
I always thought they were sisters.
No.
They look sort of similar.
Yeah.
But no. Anne Jackson is American. Glenda Jackson's British.
Yes.
Glenda Jackson's still alive and still mm-hmm. working. So
yes.
Just there's a little non-fact yes. about Anne Jackson.
Yeah. Last night, one of Anne Jackson's few TV, real movies was on TV last night, So Young, So Bad, about a sympathetic doctor trying to instill positive changes at a girls' school, a troubled girls' school. Yes, and she's kind of, she kind of reads as like a Peppermint Patty type, let's say tomboy, very tomboyish. But no, she's good in that.
She won a Tony for a play called The Middle of the Night, which was written by Patty Chayefsky, who wrote Network, which we talked about in our one of our pre episodes of the show.
Indeed.
Next up, we have Tony Burton.
Tony Burton, who plays the character Durkin.
Larry Durkin.
Yes.
Larry Durkin.
The guy who
died in 2016.
Yeah.
Also died in 2016.
Yeah. Right. He's the auto shop guy.
Yeah.
These are two mm-hmm. He was in two scenes that were, I believe, both cut out for the European release of this film.
It's interesting to me that he appears in the cast list because he I believe, has less screen time than Barry Denon,
yes.
who plays Bill Watson in the film.
Yes.
And Barry Denon is not listed in the beginning.
Not in this.
My guess is that Tony Burton at the time mm-hmm. had just come from appearing in two of the Rocky films, playing Apollo Creed's trainer, which
this is Corner Man.
Probably meant that his agent was able to get him a credit right there, even though Barry Denon was a much busier actor mm-hmm. who had a long list of credits up to that point.
Here's
Bill Watson.
Here's my theory on why he got a credit and Barry Denon didn't. Mm-hmm. Tony Burton was contracted for 1 week for these two short scenes. He ended up staying for 6 weeks. Why? Because he was really good at chess.
Mm.
And he beat Kubrick at one point in chess. Ooh. This was pretty unheard
of. So the stakes were a credit. They were betting on
credit. I believe Kubrick would fall in love with anybody who was good at chess. I believe he just, like, just, you, that made you a star in his eyes. I almost wonder if that's why Tony Burton got the credit. He was just like, give this guy a credit. He was in every single Rocky movie. One of the only people in every single Rocky mm-hmm. movie. He had been a boxer and a football player. He had been in prison for 3 years mm-hmm. for robbery. While he was mm-hmm. in prison, he got his high school degree, a college diploma, and he was in a workshop using psychodrama as therapy. And that's where mm-hmm. he discovered his calling. He ended up in the Actors Studio and is just amazing and got an amazing career and is just a swell, mm-hmm. swell guy, obviously. That's Tony Burton. And then again, missing, strangely, is Barry Denon, who, as of this recording, had been alive 5 days ago.
Wow.
He just died at the age of 79 on September 26th.
We're recording Burbank.
This. Yeah. Yeah.
He had a long career, very, very busy.
Voice actor.
Did a lot of voiceover work. And the only one of his credits I want to highlight and is that he was the voice of one of the Skeksis in The Dark Crystal.
Yes.
Ah.
His biggest role was Pontius Pilate in all of the biggest iterations of Jesus Christ Superstar play, movie, album. He had dated mm-hmm. Barbara Streisand while he was figuring out that he was gay.
Not only dated Barbara Streisand, but wrote a book about the experience.
Yes.
Wow.
And it helped launch totally helped launch her career, helped her with, this is when she was a total unknown, helped her with her nightclub act. And he starred as the master of ceremonies in Cabaret in London, which you can totally imagine. It was a fiddler on the roof.
Yes.
And played Hitler on an episode of Wonder Woman. Somebody find that.
I thought you were going to say, in bed with Barbara Streisand.
No.
He played Hitler. That was part of their, because she was Jewish, and it was a little bit of her like kinky games that she would play. He would dress as Hitler. And then she would like, she would slap him or yeah. who knows what. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. That's where I thought that was going.
But
I'm sorry.
Someone please find a clip of Barry Dennen playing Hitler on Wonder Woman. Oh, Barry Dennen had an incredible.
Or in bed with Barbara Streisand. Find me a clip of that. Find me a clip of that and I will pay you $10,000. Yeah. And we're going to see the unlisted in the opening credits, Barry Dennen in very, very briefly in the next segment of this film.
Yes.
And at which point I am going to talk about the other Shining Dark Crystal connection.
Oh, great.
Aside from Barry Dennen, there's another one.
All right. Executive producer Jan Harlan. He is the brother of Stanley Kubrick's longtime wife, Christiane Harlan. He was one of the producers on A Clockwork Orange, and then he was the executive producer on every movie after that. He was the nephew of German filmmaker Viet Harlan, who is best known for the 1940 film Sus the Jew. This is
a back to Hitler once again.
Back to Hitler. It all comes back to Hitler. Always does. Joseph Goebbels had commissioned this movie. It is famously the most anti-Semitic
horrible
film.
Yes.
Ever put to celluloid. He co-wrote the screenplay and directed it. The lead role was played by his wife. It had 20 million viewers at the time when it was released. It was a huge hit. He actually was tried for crimes against humanity for making that film.
Wow.
He went through three trials.
Wow. That's almost never happened until a couple of years ago when Grown Ups 2 came out and the producer was once again tried for crimes against humanity.
Yes.
After three trials, he was given a light sentence. He claimed it was all under duress. There's actually a lot of evidence that it was.
That little yellow car keeps driving through the
mountains. Just keeps driving.
And the terrain changes. It gets snowier as the car drives on. So you're getting a progression.
And there's nobody. There are a few other cars that they pass, but those cars seem to be pulled over to the side of the road.
Yeah.
Almost like they were asked by a production assistant to do so.
Yeah, I noticed
or a police
that
officer.
Seemingly, yeah. Yes, possibly.
Yeah, I wonder why Oh, and you're also seeing it at one point when you get past the mountains, you also see the car from above winding through the trees.
Yeah.
Almost like that sort of God's eye view of an ant.
Right.
I have seen, that's become a very popular horror movie trope. It's in The Ring, it's in Get Out, it's in Cabin in the Woods, just to name three.
And it is the feel of either an eagle soaring or an ominous presence following them. You know, it's it feels it's hard to put your finger on what it is about the way it was shot that makes it feel ominous as opposed to just a simple eagle eye shot, but somehow it is ominous.
Well, the music helps a lot. I mean, you've seen the way they cut it together for the Shine, the trailer where they cut it to make it seem like it's a comedy.
Yes, right. But I mean, the way it swoops down at the constant swooping over and that kind of thing is there's something about it that's very menacing. The next credit says based on a novel by Stephen King.
Yeah. Little known guy. It's, you know, hopefully he'll have some success sometime in the future. We'll hear more from this King fellow.
Yes. When they decided to do it, King had in his contract that he could take first crack at the screenplay. According to Kubrick, he never even read the screenplay that King wrote. I don't know if that's true. He may have been being polite, saying he didn't read it. We did get to see eventually the screenplay that King wrote because they produced it on television in a miniseries of The Shining in 1997.
Mm-hmm. And how.
I did a presentation on that for Kevin Geeks Out, which is in New York City, a monthly program where we talk about geeky subjects. And I'm going to post my talk about comparing Kubrick's Shining with Stephen King's screenplay and executive production of his own The Shining. I'm going to put that up on the website.
Yeah, and that, we should say, that version of the film, that version, that TV, made-for-TV movie, which maybe some people have seen, maybe they haven't, is the Stephen King approved version.
100%.
Yes.
That was his baby.
This is not.
All the people who have read the book and loved the book and then complain about things in the movie saying, well, they left out this subplot and they left out this story and that explanation. It's all in the TV version.
All the evidence you need of what Stephen King
wanted. All of that was left in, and you can see it's a much better film.
Yes.
according to Stephen, some people.
According to Uncle Steppy.
Now, right off the bat, they were kind of taking jabs at each other. And so shortly after the movie came out, here's a couple quotes from Kubrick about Stephen King. Quote, "I should say King's greatest ingenuity lies in his construction of the story. He does not seem to be very interested in writing itself." Okay. As a writer, ow. Stanley Kubrick also said, "The novel is by no means a literary work." Now that had to hurt if you were Stephen King to hear Kubrick say that.
Sure.
And here's what Stephen King had to say about the movie. Quote, "A great big beautiful Cadillac with no motor inside." That's how he described it. "The real problem is that Kubrick set out to make a horror picture with no apparent understanding of the genre."
Okay.
Now, when King wanted to do the miniseries on TV, Kubrick actually owned the rights to The Shining. So he had to get permission from Stanley Kubrick to do his own version of his. And in the stipulated in the contract by Stanley Kubrick was that King had to shut up about insulting his movie. That's completely true. The next credit is produced in association with the Producer Circle Company, Richard Fryer, Martin Richard, Mary Lee Johnson. You wouldn't even notice that, right? Because zipping by in the credits, who notices that? It's actually pretty interesting.
Yes.
Go ahead, Megan.
Well, Mary Lee Johnson was actually the daughter of one of the Johnsons of Johnson & Johnson fame.
She was the granddaughter of the founder of Johnson & Johnson.
She was the first baby to appear on a Johnson's Baby Powder label.
That's right.
So, when she wasn't being ignored by her very rich parents, she was being sexually abused by her father from ages 9 to 15. She was left out of her father's will.
Right. She was also first cousins with Michael Douglas.
That's right, yes. Then in 1972, she married a psychiatrist and hedonist named Dr. Victor Dark. And it was a very bad, very abusive relationship. When she said that she wanted to get divorced, well, she left him and was living with Marty Richardson. Apparently, Victor Dark sent some men to kill them.
Okay, so Martin Richards is also in the credits. We see him preceding her name. So he grew up as a singer and a wannabe actor and ended up being a producer. And he was gay. And he...
That one guy in Broadway.
Yes, that one guy. And he crossed paths with Mary Lee Johnson.
What a pariah he must have been in the theater world when that got out.
So after her nightmare divorce to this psychopath, she married Martin Richards. They had obviously a strange marriage, a gay man married to a straight woman, but by all accounts, an extremely happy marriage. Like, they were the perfect couple. They absolutely loved each other to death. They were actually physically attacked by someone that apparently the ex-husband had sicked on them and were both very badly injured. Richard Fryer was a very well-known producer. He had produced the original play of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. He produced Sweeney Todd, the original Sweeney Todd. They were great. They were all three great Broadway producers. La Cage aux Folles, they did that. And then eventually they got into movies. They did Boys from Brazil, Hotel New Hampshire, Fort Apache.
Back to Hitler.
Always comes back to Hitler. Just the very last credit is screenplay by Stanley Kubrick and Diane Johnson. Diane Johnson was a very well-known author at the time, and in decades or so following, Stanley had been kind of interested in one of her books, The Shadow Knows, from 1974, as a possible movie source. She was a teacher at UC Berkeley, teaching a course on the Gothic novel, which Kubrick was really interested in that she was an expert in the Gothic novel and Gothic concepts. He worked with her in the UK for 3 months, working on the script, like, constant, like, just, you know, in the trenches, nonstop. She was at his estate writing this thing. While they were writing, they watched Jack Nicholson films and Star Wars. That was one of their preparatory films.
Yep.
Joe Dater.
Well, everyone's watching Star Wars. The late 70s, come on. What are you going to do?
Yeah. It's almost mandatory.
Yeah, it was the law, actually. People would come around to your house and make sure you had seen it.
It's true. Yes.
Armed 20th Century Fox was sending jackbooted thugs mm-hmm. around to people's houses to make sure they had mm-hmm. seen Star Wars at that point. So,
and we're back to Hitler.
Absolutely
okay.
mandatory. And we're back to back to Hitler now.
All right. So, and just really quickly, before we even begin the film, three movies that he had everybody who was involved with the film watch to prep themselves mm-hmm. for the act of filming was The Exorcist, which he loved. He had been offered actually to direct that and turned it down.
Speaking of gothic, yes.
Yeah. It was also Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. which we will see glimpses of that, I believe, in The Shining, and David Lynch's Eraserhead.
Ah.
Everybody had to watch it.
Feel-good movie. Yep.
He wanted to get the feel of Eraserhead in this movie.
Yes.
This film has not begun.
This
is first 2 minutes, 37. That has been the first 2 minutes, 37 seconds of The Shining.
Thank you a million times to Megan Dooley and Joe Dader for being on the first episode of The Shining 237 podcast. It was a marathon episode. There was a lot to cover. Most episodes will be shorter than that. Please do visit the website. I'll have a lot of extras posted there. I also have a tip jar, if you don't mind, and you can. Please do leave a tip, since this is a labor of love and it's actually quite a lot of work. Please join us on Facebook and or on Twitter. We will soon be on iTunes and in other formats easily accessible to everyone. Thank you for listening, and I will see you again for episode number 2, where we will be assured by the heroine of the film that we're all going to have a real good time.